Thanks for tuning in to today's podcast. Please remember that all of the information in this podcast episode is limited to general information only. That means the information is not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so you should seek the advice of a licensed and trusted financial professional before acting on the information. And before you acquire or apply for a financial product, please read the PDS, or Product Disclosure Statement, which should be available on the issuer's website. Lastly, please keep in mind that past performance is not indicative of future performance. Welcome to this episode of the Australian Investors Podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Anirban Mahatni, Investment Advisor at Seven Investing. We're diving straight into results. We've got Redbubble, CSL, ProMedicus, NetWealth, and Nearmap, amongst many others that we mentioned throughout the show. We get to the results about 20 or so minutes into the conversation, so feel free to skip ahead if you just want the meat from this podcast. This podcast was recorded in video via Zoom, so you can jump onto the Rask Australia YouTube page by jumping into the podcast player in front of you. That will show you a link to go and watch the full version. I think it's important because we actually share our screens and talk through the results and what to look for. You can also find at the end of the show two stock ideas for your watch list, one global growth company and a small cap Aussie company that's just created or just made a divestment. Really interesting businesses, both of them. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Australian Investors Podcast, and stay safe. G'day, mate. Welcome back to the show.
G'day, mate. Nice to be back again.
Yeah. We crowdsourced some ideas for today's recording, which is great. We're recording this on Thursday, August 19th, and it will go live on the 21st at 7 a.m. We're recording in video too, so if you do have time, you can sit by the smart TV or phone or laptop or whatever and watch us. If you want to join in the conversation on Twitter, head to 7A Mahanti or at Owen Rask. You'll find the links in the show notes. You can actually have a chat with us, and we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you think of the companies we're about to talk about, what's going on in reporting season, and so on and so forth. Anyway, mate, how's lockdown?
You just asked me that before. No, you let me vent out before that. Well, lockdown. Well, look, lockdown is lockdown. Oh, it has its own. You know, I think the lockdown has a lot of effect, I guess, on kids stuck at home. For people like us who are used to stay at home, the only thing really that has relatively changed for me is my opportunity to go and spend some time at my favorite coffee shops and spend some money there, mm-hmm. and talk to some real people in person. That's changed for me. But what's really changed, and my wife works in healthcare, so she goes to work every day, whereas I think it's changed for my daughter in the sense that she's stuck at home. And I think, you know, it's really, lockdown is really hard on children. So that's my take.
Yeah. It's hard on children, hard on parents, hard on everyone. But children in particular, like, rely on it, right? They rely on the development, the community to get that kind of support that they need as they develop. So yeah. Okay. So before, we also talked about one other thing, just off.
You just asked me the hard question. I was going to say, there was a time when Sydney was in lockdown, but yes. Melbourne wasn't. But now Melbourne is in lockdown too. So I can smile and ask you the same question. How's lockdown for you? Sorry, I'm making fun of this.
We're laughing. It's okay. You got it.
I'm sympathetic.
if you guys in New South Wales didn't spread it to us, then we wouldn't have got it, and neither would New Zealand or anywhere else. So you guys are to blame. I'm just kidding. But
here's the funny thing, right? Since you said New Zealand, I'll make a sly comment.
Okay.
You know, so the Kiwis thought that, you know, they basically can keep a virus out by just pretending that the virus doesn't exist, right? Well, quarantine and everything else. You know, what I've been saying for a long time is the virus will find its way in. And in fact, if you think it's not going to find its way in, then you're going to be unprepared for it, and it's going to then replicate inside, and then you're going to find out, oh, there's a virus. So I think that's my bob's worth of, you know, viruses are very smart and they're really tiny and small, so that's about viruses. So yeah, you can blame the New South Wales people, you know, but I'd say we can blame the virus.
Yeah,
and you want to carry this forward, Delta, it came from India, so you can blame all the Indians like me. The Indians in turn can then blame the Chinese. The Chinese can blame the bats, and maybe the bats can blame the Americans.
Yeah, how far back do we need to go? No, to be honest with you, in all seriousness, yeah, I mean, lockdown's not great, right?
Yeah, so, definitely not great. Yeah.
Yeah. We're in the, as I've said to you and many others, we're in the middle of a reno as well. So the house is half done. You look around, you want to do things, and this is too much. So I think a hard thing is actually, you know, we always talk about Apple on the show, and we should be able to challenge ourselves, see if we can go a week without it. Mm-hmm. But seeing that I've just brought it up, this investment in the Apple Watch, I've got to tell you, has been one of the best investments I've made for health reasons. Because it reminds me to get up and go for a walk, practice mindfulness. You know, it winds down my devices at night so I don't have as much light coming in and, you know, all these types of things. And I think I'm very fortunate if I could pay some gratitude to a device during lockdown. It's reminded me to keep busy, keep active. I hear of a lot of people during lockdown just kind of giving up on all their goals, which I understand. I did that during the last lockdown. I think we're in number six here in Victoria. I didn't want to go back there. So I'm glad for that and thankful for that. But yeah, I mean, we're very fortunate. You can't really see it on the screen here out the window, but like you, we have, you know, some green grass and some trees around us, which is really nice. So just trying to be thankful for all those things, mate. And enjoy reporting season. I remember when I was in high school, my specialist maths teacher would say to me, you know, I don't know what you guys are worried about. Exam time is the best time of year because you get to see and check in on everyone's reports and see how they've done. And I was like, yep, that's not my cup of tea. But now as an investor, I love these times of year because you get to see what's actually been going on. And we've got some great reports to share with you today. Mate, before we get to that, you were saying just off air a moment ago that I think you've released 5 recommendations for 7 investing and they've all done pretty well so far. You know, short-term track record, you know, all that stuff.
But that was not supposed to be put out in public. And you know, this is not scripted. It's not in the script just for anybody else. You know, I was just getting the steam out and, you know, it's like good to have a short-term win. No investor, I think, can have 100% track record. So I fully expect not to have 100% track record. And even just the beat with respect to the market, like, you know, if that just compounds, it's some unholy type of compounding. So it can't happen. I've been pretty lucky, I think, you know, just in terms of timing of some of these stocks. They've just been picked, you know, right before earnings. People thought they were overvalued. So maybe, but you know, the earnings just turned out to be great. So,
And we've got one for it at the end of the show. So be sure to listen on for that one, which is really interesting business. But hey, you got to, sometimes I feel like with track records too, you just got to take what you can in the short term. Sometimes, you know, it's great for fund managers. It's great for stock pickers. It's great for individuals to start out at a time when they can, it's fortuitous, lucky, whatever you want to call it. When you can start out and things actually go well from the beginning, it makes your track record look great. It makes you feel great. So kudos to you, mate. It's all going well so far and let's expect it to continue, but maybe with a few bumps along the way. So I know you've been busy working on that. We had in the show notes here just to talk all the talking points, just to talk about what we've been working on lately. I'll start perhaps just company reports. This time of year is crazy with August. Last night I was up to about 8:30, just going through some numbers. I know a lot of people stay up later than that during this time of the year working. But we're actually releasing a report on Nanosonics today. So this is Thursday. Nanosonics is a really interesting Australian business. Raymond, who's one of our analysts, a great analyst and editor of our RAS Media website, he actually came out and found some really interesting things. So he actually, I won't give too much away, but one of the things that he did was actually said that his uncle was starting a medical practice and needed an ultrasound disinfectant device, which Nanosonics creates, and then called all of the distributors in Australia, as well as all of the competitors, and compared prices and tried to get their inside scoop on the different products. And what he found was really interesting. So that's Nanosonics, ASX ticker code NAN. I know it's a fan favorite because it's a big company, multi-billion dollar company, I think now. How about you, mate? What have you been working on? So I know you've just got some recommendations. Anything interesting, any tidbits that you can share with us before we get into the companies?
Yeah, what I've been working on. So just general things. So, of course, always looking for companies, studying companies and things like that. But I'm looking forward to Tesla's AI days tomorrow. That's I'm not working on that, but I'm in very much interested in seeing what's going to be there. I've worked on a report, which I think is interesting, which is about sort of the state of cloud security, or not just cloud security, actually state of security, computer networking security as such. And I think that's pretty interesting. We're going to release that as a special sort of free report. But
how do you go about researching that?
Well, so researching that. So I have a background in computing. So I know sort of what the tech is, right? And then sort of, I think the interesting thing here is there used to be an accepted state of the art for, okay, this is how you secure your network infrastructure, your IT infrastructure and things like that. But that's rapidly changing in today's world because of cloud and because of multi-cloud and because of hybrid cloud and private cloud and things like that, right? So there's a lot of shift happening. And then at the same time, there's a lot of more attacks happening, which is also a function of just the expansion of the internet and the availability of internet and compute capabilities and things like that, right? So, more people actually have access to horsepower to actually do attacks, launch attacks and be clever about it, right? And sometimes hacking is a game because people think, well, if I can hack some of the most secure services, then, I'm really good, right? It's like a high. And sometimes it's not really intent on doing bad things. It's not necessarily a bad actor thing. That's there too. But it's just, okay, I can disrupt and that proves that I'm smart, right? Mm-hmm. Or a bunch of people, that proves that they're smart. So, but there's been an arise. So just looking at that and seeing the state of the art and what's changing and what's, where sort of we are headed. So that was really exciting thing to do.
Great. So did you say that would be a free report?
Yeah, that'll be a free report. Yeah. I think it should be released in the week or so, next few days, I think we're hoping will be available from our site.
Yep, 7investing.com. That's great. I will have a read of that. Okay, so one thing that's really interesting is the jobless rate has been falling. I thought this was an interesting thing. It's not something that I necessarily follow really closely, but I guess it's one of the most important barometers or benchmarks for assessing the health of the economy. Did you have any particular takeaways from this? And if so, can we action them as investors?
Yeah, so at a very high level, right? So it dropped below 5, which is like a substantial, I think it has not dropped below 5 in a long, long time in Australia. But I think if you look below it, actually it is the reason it has dropped below this is the pandemic or the reason really the lockdowns, because some people basically have gotten out of the job market. They're not no longer looking for jobs because there are no jobs because things are locked down. And that has, I think, contributed to the number going down. Mm-hmm. So I think this is probably a bit of a, a measurement anomaly or anomaly because of how things are, but the general trend though is interesting, right? Because the general trend has been that there's some sort of competition for jobs happening. Mm. The jobless numbers have been going down. If I had to hypothesize, I would say that, it's mostly, I think the issue is that we've always had a steady supply of different types of labor that comes into the market, whether it's holidaymakers or at the high end, specialized workforce. No, none of those things are coming. Neither the high end is coming, nor the holidaymaking, holidaymaker workforce is there. And that's basically providing impetus to drive the jobless rate down. That's sustainable in the long run? I don't know. It's not that the system is creating more jobs than it used to. I don't think it's a productivity gain as such, but that's my interpretation. It's a labor shortage cost, which is essentially caused by multitude of reasons. But yeah, so I wouldn't share this particular one largely because I think this is caused by the NSW lockdowns, for example.
Mm. It's really interesting, just anecdotal evidence and feedback that I've been getting from a lot of small business owners is that it is incredibly difficult to get labor. So particularly blue collar workers. So many people have commented to me lately that, effectively they just can't find them for one reason or another. A lot of people are, you know, taking care of kids because of lockdowns and the threat of lockdowns. A lot of people haven't had to go back to work, whether it's for stimulus reasons or for whatever. We haven't had that issue at RASC. I can tell you that much. We've had a lot of people applying for jobs, but I've heard of people, for example, putting job ads out and not getting a bite for 2 or 3 months. So, I mean, eventually that will trickle through, right? If it is, maybe this is a bit of, I guess, the number you need to look into, how the number is calculated. But beyond that, maybe perhaps it's a sign that wage inflation might come back.
Well, maybe wage inflation comes back. You know, if wage inflation comes back, though, maybe that's not actually necessarily a good thing, because that would mean interest rates kind of need to go up. If the interest rates actually start going up, that has its own whole set of other problems that it can cause. And I'm not really talking about equity valuations, right? I'm just saying that, you know, there's indebtedness that's around in the society that, you know, will now start costing more to service. So it's really, I mean, I don't know where the, you know, it's like a, I guess there's an equilibrium point, right? You know, there's, you want to be at that equilibrium point and not above or below that. So we'll see. I don't know. Wage inflation is something that central banks love. And I just have, you know, I just think that the wage inflation is very hard to get because of various reasons. And technology is one of the biggest reasons that, you know, we're not getting wage inflation.
I don't think we do a good enough job of measuring that impact to really get a good handle on it, at least from what I've seen so far. Okay, let's move on. One of the comments that came through on Twitter was this idea of investing in Chinese tech now. Is this kind of the new normal, or is this a time when it's an opportunity for investors to get in cheap, so to speak? You know, we know many of the big names like Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, all of these companies have been in and out of the news feed. You only have to watch Bloomberg for 10 minutes to know that something's going on. Can you maybe just fill us in on kind of what's happened? Some of the key things to be mindful of as well.
Yeah, so I think it's very interesting. I don't really have a view. I can give an overview of what's happening. So there's been a crackdown on tech, China tech, right? So I don't know what exactly the reasons have been on crackdown, but there's, you know, various regulations have been pulled. You know, they've been asked to do certain things a certain way. There's fears that some of them are monopolies and things like that. That's one side. The other side of the story that's been printed, and again, I'm not, you know, this is not my opinion, is that some of this has been done because there has been, you know, these geopolitical tensions and between the US and China. A lot of the Chinese companies actually love to list, at least, you know, their scripts on the US, in the US markets. And at least definitely they have ADRs and things like that. And those stocks are then held by investors there or global investors, right? So this is a, you know, some people are saying this is an indirect way to cause pain to investors, right? So I think DD, which went public, had some issues and stock catered after the IPO. You know, after IPO, stock catering is really regarded as a bad thing. You could argue that it's actually a good thing in the sense that, you know, the people, the selling shareholders actually got a good deal, right? If the stock goes up, then the selling shareholders actually got a bad deal, but that's not the usual interpretation.
Depends what side of the fence you're on.
But yeah, so it was painted as a bad thing. So a lot of things like Alibaba, Tencent would look cheap relative to their scale and valuation. And so like you have to have a view on how this is going to play out. If there was a natural course for things to play out and the, you know, geopolitical tensions didn't matter in this game, then there's definitely an argument to be made that these are cheap. And as an aggregate, you could basically buy a basket, for example. You could buy, like, you know, there's like a ETF, the Beta Shares Asian Tigers ETF, for example. It's, you know, for Australian listeners, they can just basically get the Asia ETF as a basket approach, right? And that they would get a good deal on the basket. And it includes ex-China stuff as well. But you have to believe that at some point, these companies are going to be not impacted significantly by regulations and geopolitical tensions. And in that case, you know, you're basically getting probably a 30%, 40% discount to where maybe it should be trading, right? Mm. So that you have to have the view. That's what I think, you know. I don't know whether it's an example of asymmetric payoffs, right? I mean, tails means that things don't work out. How bad can it get? I don't know. Maybe it can get really worse, but I don't know. That's my view. You have to have a view on the future of these companies.
Mm. I'm just looking at Alibaba's enterprise value to free cash flow in the past. Since June 20th, it's fallen from over 30 to now down to 18 times free cash flow. Yeah. So
it's really cheap.
Yeah, it's quite a retraction for a business that just a couple of years ago was, you know, touted as, you know, a game changer for Asia. So really, really interesting. Was part of this crackdown when WeChat, Tencent's WeChat was blocked as well? Was that?
Yeah, part of that, I think, you know, well, it all started with Jack Ma, right? Something happened with, you know, Jack Ma was underground. And since then, it's just been one after the other. There's been some issue or the other, right? Now, you could say that there's a market power issue too, right? I mean, some of these companies have a lot of market power. If you think about like an Alibaba, Tencent, right? These are not small companies, right? You know, even after all the, you know, share price drop, these are what, like $400, $500 billion market cap company. So the valuations are certainly attractive, and the growth rates, right? So if you look at Alibaba's growth rates, it's not like a company growing at 10%. It's a company growing at 30-40%, you know, its GMV probably is growing at like, you know, 50% or something like that. So these are not just another large cap slow growth company. These are like, you know, blue chip, high growth companies.
Yeah. So, like last year, revenue growth of 41%. So yeah, big numbers, huge.
Big numbers. So yeah.
Yeah. And so I've always been concerned about them. I don't know if you have a view on this or not, but I've always been concerned about basically how you get exposure to them. Like you mentioned, there's the Asia ETF here in Australia. There are a couple of others that have exposure to China or Asia, generally speaking. But there's a lot of issue around also kind of the legal structure of the companies as well and what you actually own.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of...
I have never been worried about the legal structure, the voting rights and things like that. So there's like, you know, your weird structure with, the, you know, some holding company that has promised to pay its entirety of its profits into some other holding company that's Netherlands-based and things like that. These are regulation based. What if you take the view that regulators aren't going to impinge upon the security holders of some form and are willing to let the companies run due course while following law, then I think, you know, you needn't be concerned. But, you know, they're just but the current sort of situation where there have been a string, you know, it sounds like too much of a coincidence, right? That every tech company out of China is under attack. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when does it end? You don't know. Or which company is next? You don't know. I mean, those are the things, but you know, the valuations are attractive. These are really good companies. Like, I mean, if you think about the tech, you know, sort of they have been pushing forward, the forward thinking, high growth, you know, so.
Mm.
But yeah, exposure-wise, if you wanted direct exposure, you could buy ADRs or you could buy the stock directly off Hong Kong, the stock exchange for many of them. Otherwise, an exposure via some ETF is an approach which gives you a basket of, you know, and maybe that's better to have a basket because, you know, you don't have to look at specific companies.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. When we opened our ETF service over the weekend, a lot of people were asking, you know, there's only one exposure to Asia. Why is that? And I mean, there are a few answers for that. One of them is basically how much do you need? But the other one was just about what's the right exposure. We often take an approach to Asian equities that is an active first approach, just because with still some I guess, asymmetry around the information that's available. I think that investors in the region can add alpha. So we've backed the FEMX ETF from Fidelity. So it's a really interesting ETF. You could probably contrast that to the Asian technology tigers if you wanted. Just a different, more active exposure. We might move on to some companies if that's okay. The first one that we've got on the list today is probably the one that's divided the market, at least at the time of recording. And just to put it in context, I think it was down 13% when it opened this morning. And the last I checked, this is Redbubble, is up 16%. So a 29% turnaround in a single day of trading. I said to the guys at the analysts at RASC this morning, because we've recommended this company previously, and I said to them, and it's one that I own a very modest amount of shares in, I said, you know, I think you'll be surprised where it ends the day. I think at the beginning of the day, it's mostly retail investors who kind of react to things and speculation. And by the end of the day, you tend to have people with a bit more of an informed view of the news. And so if I just go over some of the high level numbers, marketplace revenue, maybe just what it is. So Redbubble is a global platform that connects independent artists. So someone that wants to create something, say like a sticker or something to go on a pencil case or an apron or a t-shirt or a cap or something like that. I'm an artist. I go to the platform. I upload my artwork. You can be a user. You go visit the platform via the app or via the website, and you can get my creative on whatever thing that you want it on. So whether it's a cushion, a cap, or whatever, you can get my artwork on that. Redbubble sits in the middle of that and something called a fulfiller, which is like a manufacturing site. So you can think of a fulfiller just basically like a manufacturing site. They have dozens around the world. These are independent fulfillers. Redbubble takes the payment from you, and then it sends that money to me and to the fulfiller in a few weeks' time once they've got the payment cleared and what have you. And so that's what Redbubble does. Basically tries to attract artists and tries to attract users onto the platform so then it can make this transaction happen. And it takes about, for every $100, it takes about $30 from the transaction, I believe. I'll just double check that. I've got the results here in front of me. Yeah, the take rate is around about $31. And so Redbubble came out this morning, $553 million of marketplace revenue. That's what they call it. And artists got about $104 million of that. Gross profit at $223 million, and it ended the period with $99 million of cash in the bank. The thing to keep in mind with Redbubble is obviously we're starting to lap a lot of the COVID numbers from a year ago. So during COVID last year, people didn't know where to get their masks. You probably remember that everyone didn't know where they could get a mask. The N95s had sold out. So what's the next best thing? Typically, it was your auntie or uncle who knew how to sew would send you a mask and you would use that. But the other thing that you could do is you could jump onto Redbubble and you could get a custom-made mask and get it delivered to you. And so that artificially propped up results. Another thing that we just saw across all businesses from Microsoft and Amazon right down to businesses like this, we saw that, you know, there's a massive, in some instances, a pull forward of demand, or sometimes it just accelerated demand and the structural shift was already in play. It just kind of sped it up a bit. Redbubble was definitely a beneficiary of that trend. Its cash flow was huge and it really, really just took it in its stride. But this year, we're starting to see it lap that. So the concern amongst most investors, as far as I can see, I mean, there are some first level thinking type investors out there approaching it saying it's got very thin margins. It's more like a retailer, therefore it is risky, who perhaps don't really understand the business model. But then there are people who say that this is kind of like a one-trick pony. Maybe it doesn't come back. The thing that I would like people to keep in mind, my concern was that basically it would have to ramp spending. In the past, Redbubble was dependent on Google search to get all of its customer acquisition. That's not so much the case anymore, with around, I think it's around about 50% or more of the marketplace revenue now being conducted on app. And a lot of that, I think about 42% is repeat usage. So more customers staying with them, more customers coming through the app to pay is positive. The other thing that I'll add is that there has been a lot of criticism of Redbubble and its inability to deal with fakes and people that upload content, which is not legitimate. And so it infringes upon intellectual property rights. On the call this morning, management effectively said that they disagree with some court findings, which may suggest, or analyst views, which may suggest that they didn't do enough. The other thing, they didn't really, you know, have too much pushback against. Yes, you know, this has happened. People are using the platform to sell goods, which probably do infringe on copyright, but we do our best to get rid of it ASAP. My understanding of it, and a lot of this is still in the courts, is that because Redbubble inadvertently, you could say, or indirectly acts as the fulfiller, even though it's not, it's a third party that does that, that opens it up to different forms of litigation than, say, Amazon, which is completely outsourced, or some other type of like Etsy, like a platform like that. So in the short of it is, I came away very positive about the company, to be honest. And I know that's very, very stark compared to what we've seen in the Twitter sphere and the Twitterati. A lot of people that don't agree with that view. But I think as the business scales, attracts more artists, attracts more users, we're going to see more cash flow spin out of it over time. The next 6 months are going to be very tough as they keep lapping COVID. Anyway, I could go on forever, but to be honest, the stock was down 13% when I met with the team this morning, and they didn't know as much about it as I did. And they said, I said, what do you think of it? And they said, oh, you know, there's this and that. And I said, you know, I think it was actually a brilliant result, and I wouldn't be surprised to see the shares shoot up from here. I don't no day trader, but anyway, as I just finished my spiel, mate, before I let you go, shares are up 18%. So quite the reversal.
You should have bought some shares in the morning.
I know.
When it was down 13 or whatever, and you'd have made a killing.
I know. But the thing is, one, I'm no good at that stuff. If I put money down, it probably would have kept going down. And the second thing is I have to wait 5 days anyway because of our trading rules. So by then, who knows what would be happening. So, yeah, I mean, I probably sound like I'm quite smug here, but we're actually well underwater with where we recommended Redbubble. So, you know, I'm thankful that it's up so far. I acknowledge that there's still a lot of risks, but I think a lot of the cash flows here to stay. I think a lot of investors, generally speaking, have had trouble differentiating between what has been pulling forward a structural thematic and pulling forward something just because it was during COVID and during lockdown. And so I think this is more along the structural lines. I think more people want bespoke creative goods. And I think Redbubble has the potential to become basically the internet's repository for creativity. Because once an artist comes to the platform and creates their, let's call it a shopping site or like their own little author profile, once they've created that, there is no incentive for them to leave because they may as well keep the art there, because in 6 months or a year from now, someone might want whatever that was and put it on their mug, in which case they get paid for having no incremental effort. So I think that's something that's quite interesting. You know, we don't release this podcast for another 2 days, but the share price is now up 18%. So I think we're moving the market every minute that we talk about it. But anyway, I don't know. That was my company. It was kind of like a fan favorite today in terms of very polarizing, but I still really like the business. I own some shares. I'll probably buy more in a few weeks, but yeah, that's Redbubble.
Yeah, I like this is like a three-sided network, right? You know, you have people coming in, which bring the artists. The artists are going to bring the people, right? And then more people coming in means it's worthwhile for the artists. And then there are more fulfillment, you know, people will come in because it's, you know, they're getting some work. Mm. So I think it's an interesting model. But this problem of COVID lap up is going to be there for a lot of businesses, right? I mean,
that's it.
You know, a lot of online businesses are going to have this issue of COVID. And so I think thinking about it more long-term normalized is really useful, right? And the way to think about this is let's say, does it, you know, you said what, it was 50%, 60% growth this year, something like that, or some ridiculous number?
I think it's 47%.
Okay, so some ridiculously high number, 47%, right? Let's say next year it grows only 10%. Hmm. But it's that 10% on top of the 47% that it did is. It's a much larger base, right? Hmm. And you can normalize that and average that and say, well, you know, it's 10% here plus 47%. I'm just making up the number. I don't know what the guidance is. But, you know, whatever it is, it's on top of that. So that's just something to, you know, as long as it's not going backwards, I guess, that means it's growing its network, which I think is really powerful.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised to see growth rates go back slightly backwards in the second half, just simply because it has grown so quickly. And I think the experience of Etsy and Pinterest has shown us that, you know, when people get out of the home, it can actually have an impact. That said, Australia's, and I made this point on the call, Australia is the exception. Most of the world is no longer in lockdown. So they are out doing things. They are out spending money. And, you know, that kind of the mentality that we have right now, and I think this is something investors always fall foul to, is kind of the recency bias and how kind of our personal experience impacts our view of things at large. I think that once we return to regular programming, I tend to believe that it'll be very strong. This company, I believe, has been around for over a decade now. It's not a business. It survived perfectly well, not in COVID. Yes, COVID accelerated it, but I think it's now got a foothold to reinvest more back into the business. I would actually show you. It's right over in the corner there. I do actually have a print from Redbubble. And this is an interesting little thing. People don't understand this, but I often have that on some podcasts. It's got some of you who've watched our podcast before may know it's got Warren Buffett dressed up as like a Marilyn. It's kind of like a creative version of Warren Buffett. And I reckon I've had about four other podcasters reach out to me to say, hey, where'd you get that print from? I want one for my backdrop. And so that's a tiny little network effect for Redbubble there. So it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting business anyway. Let's go from one company with a red logo to another company with a red logo, which is a much bigger company, mate. One of the comments that came through on Twitter was, can you take a look at CSL? I've got to admit, I don't follow CSL that closely. Rudy Philippek van Dijk, who many of you will know, regularly appears on AusBiz and elsewhere, suggested that it was an interesting year, but the secret is kind of what happens next in terms of blood plasma collection. Can you just fill us in for those people like me who don't really follow CSL that closely, what it does?
CSL, well, I don't follow it that closely. I actually follow it for different reasons. I find it is an interesting company of what I call an overpriced stock that has been overpriced for a decade. that doesn't mean I am wrong. I haven't been saying it's overpriced, but I've been saying it's overpriced for some time. but it doesn't mean I'm wrong. It's just a fascinating example of what investor interest can do to actually show. Well, you said small stock prices move. This is a classic example of superannuation funds responsible for bumping up the price of probably the largest company on the ASX. So at a very high level, it has two business lines, right? It has a blood plasma business line, basically bloods and various things that you need for bloods, platelets, and God knows what else. It's called blood plasma. And it has basically a vaccine line, which is a flu line, right? None of them, if you think about it, none of them are, I would say, bloods have been around for the longest possible time. And flu has been around and flu vaccines have been around, and they're largely, you know, on some years, they're largely ineffective. They have only 40% effectiveness on some years. So, I mean, flu vaccines, and there's a lot of competition in that space, right? So, yeah. So in my mind, it is basically another biotech that does a couple of different things, does them well. And then if you
feel like you're going to get, I feel like you're going to get in trouble. There's going to be some backlash.
Well, but you know, I'm just saying that, you know, influenza vaccines, you know, like it's a viral vector vaccine. Here's the classic example I like to give for this. People don't realize this, but do you know that which is the largest vaccine maker in the world?
Don't know.
You can guess where it is. It's a private company called Serum Institute in India, in Pune.
Okay.
Right. Guess what vaccine it's making right now? It's making the AstraZeneca vaccine, just like CSL is producing, right? Anybody can, you know, on, I guess anybody can manufacture these vaccines, viral vector vaccines, if you find the ingredients and have the manufacturing plant. It's not cutting edge, is my point, mm-hmm. right? Similarly, I guess blood plasma thing. I mean, there are Largan and others also do blood plasma. There are hundreds of companies that do blood plasma. They do it well. The other thing to keep in mind is, like, I mean, revenue is up 10%, right? I mean, this company is priced with what God knows what the PE is, but it's some sky high PE for a company that's growing revenue at 10%. So I just find it as a very interesting case of. I'll share a screen like we always do, mm-hmm. just to make it interesting, right? Screen sharing has, you know, Owen likes to keep tight control on me, so the screen sharing has been disabled.
I've got to change that.
So now let's try again. Oh, he's still disabled. He just doesn't want me to.
There you go. Give it a shot now. There we go. And while you do that, I've got the P ratio here in front of me. Or price to revenues for CSL, 10 times revenue is what it's at the moment. The interesting thing.
Yeah. So.
Yep. Sorry, you go.
So let's, you know, so PE is what, like, is about nearly 38 or something like that?
I think it's 40.
40. Okay. Yeah. So you've got your company growing net profit here, 10%, revenue up 10%, right? Mm-hmm. And it's basically, you know, CSL Behring, which is all these, you know, blood stuff, and the Seqirus, which is basically the vaccine stuff. They're one of the leading producers in 130 million doses distributed globally. It was a good year for distributing them. The other thing that I like looking for this company is, which is probably not in this slide. Let's see if they give that. Here's financial highlight. You know, everybody here likes to talk about EBIT and all those nice things. EBIT margins are pretty high. Mm. What I like to look at is, okay, for a company with $100 billion plus market capitalization, what's the free cash flow that you generate? Mm. Right? And the thing with this company is that it has pretty high. That's one thing I think the slides don't talk about, which I find very interesting about that. Slides don't talk about free cash flow. I will point out the Tesla slides do talk about free cash flow, just to further antagonize some people.
$1.1 billion, I think, is the free cash flow. That's according to CapIQ. Yeah. Oh, that's forward factors,
right. I mean, if you go back to 2012, 2013, 2014, somewhere that, it's been roughly around that point.
Mm. Yeah, it's been pretty consistent.
Pretty consistent around that, you know, one, and some years is a little bit more, maybe 2 billion or so, and things like that. So really, if this is a $100 billion plus company, and you're looking at discounting the future free cash flows, you really have to have some very high expectations of free cash flow, you know, dynamics, right? Going into the future to justify sort of the valuation. That's been my knock against, it's not against the company. It's a good company. It's not a great company, but it's priced like a great company. Mm. Right. And I think that's your takeaway. Yeah. That's my takeaway basically. Right. And I mean, anybody owning this company basically is making the bet. And thus far, they would have been right that the multiple is going to expand at a faster rate than their profits or free cash flow.
What's interesting about this? So 87 times free cash flow is the current multiple. But what's interesting, I don't know if you've picked up on this over the years too, is that CSL's debt has been growing rapidly over the past 5 years, maybe say 5 to 8 years. And it's basically transitioned, in my opinion, from operating leverage into financial leverage. So,
yes,
and I think that explains why some of the, you know, the dividends have been growing, and some of the other things like the ROE has been growing, because that obviously doesn't capture debt. So a few things about it have been, you know, few of the metrics have been moving, you know, up pretty well. But I think if you do, as you say, focus on that free cash flow line, you probably, yeah, as traditional kind of analysts focusing on that metric, it probably hasn't been as inspiring, you could say.
Yeah, like, I mean, as you said, like, if you're generating, say, let's say $2 billion of free cash flow, and you're, you know, and this is actually, I think, American dollars, right? So let's say if you generate, you know, whatever, 2 billion Australian, mm-hmm. let's give or take, at 130 billion, whatever is the market capitalization, you're paying a lot, very high multiple, right? And my usual comment to this is, before owning a blue chip like that, just go buy Apple. And people will come back, oh, but Apple is not a biotech. I said, why do you really need a biotech, which is, you know, just, you know, puddling along, generating some small, tiny amounts of free cash flow? You could have hundreds of, they could buy a CSL every year, just buy that. Right? And they would probably not buy a CSL because they would be saying, oh, they would look at it and say, this is ridiculous. We're not going to buy CSL. We're just going to buy our own shares instead. So that's my knock. But yeah, hey, I think this is a perfect example of a phenomena of, you know, people, funds moving and funds being restricted to, say, buying, say, blue chip, right? You might actually find the fund that is buying blue chip is not going to be buying Redbubble as a classic example, right? And the number of blue chip companies that you can find with a profit and, you know, with a good ROE, which is showing on show up on the screen, is going to be actually really tiny. And that's pushing the price up, especially for those funds that are just restricted to looking at the assets. They are not looking at the smaller ones because they can't, or their mandate says they shouldn't. And this is a classic example, I think, of demand supply distortion. Anyway, that's my take. Again, I have no way to prove it, but I think that's, you know, I think nobody can justify the price on a future free cash flow discounted basis. I think that's probably the problem.
That's polarizing. We've picked two polarizing companies so far. Red that's logos, red logos, blood red. Everyone's just blood boils, and we'll face the backlash when this goes live. But yeah, so it's a really interesting business. I think there'll be people with opinions on this one, you know, for or against. It's not a company I've ever owned, just simply because I just haven't owned it, and I haven't really thought about it too much in terms of being like a growth idea. But I know a lot of people have done really well. I think it's, you know, it's CSL, CommBank, and BHP are the age old, three decade old kind of, look how well, you know, these Australian blue chips have done. So this is definitely one of those three. The next company which we have on our list, which is surprise, surprise, is Pro Medicus, which from one healthcare company to another, or health tech company. Pro Medicus creates two pieces of software for those people who don't know it. One is an radiology information software or system. It's called RIS, R-A-S. And the other one is something called Visage. And Visage is basically, if I could explain it in the loosest possible terms, it's basically Netflix for radiology images. So you're in a hospital environment, you take, say, an X-ray, and then it appears on someone's iPhone, being, you know, radiologist or doctor, and they can inspect the images. The way Pro Medicus monetizes its business is it forms agreements with hospital systems, predominantly in the USA, for Visage, where it can monetize through a very modest kind of upfront fee, but mainly based on usage. So for every exam that goes through, they clip the ticket. And I'll share my screen with people just so we can all play along. Share screen. Here we go. Share that one, and I'll bring it up if I can get this out of the way. We have, that is not the right company. Here we go. So we've got Pro Medicus. As I said, it does Visage and Visage RIS, or RAS, just there on the left. RIS is mainly an Australian story. Visage is the US story. They actually acquired the underlying technology for Visage. It was all completely built in Germany, where they still have their development team and their head of technology and their head of development. So the business, yeah, obviously has grown very strongly over the last few years. I think it is probably the highest quality software company on the ASX. I know that might be a stretch for some people, but for me, it definitely isn't. It's a company we recommended many years ago, and it's doing quite well. I've interviewed Sam Hupert for the show as well. Some of our regular listeners will know that he was on the program not too long ago. But here we go. We've got the exam licensing revenue split. And you can see here a lot of this revenue is recurring in nature, super high margin recurring revenue. You know, an EBIT margin north of 50% is the norm for Pro Medicus. And the reason that it can do that is once it installs its archives and its rendering software and solutions, it can basically just clip the ticket on very, very low margins, incremental costs, I should say. So it's a really interesting business. If you go through and you look at it, one of the figures that they'll constantly talk about is this thing called forward revenue. Sam on the call this week said that they've effectively baked in $320 million Australian dollars of revenue over the next 5 years, but most contracts are 7 years. So there's 2 extra years for free on the end there. But at the end of the day, mate, what this comes back to is valuation. You know, this is a company with a multi-billion dollar valuation as it stands. And the reality is that $320 million, while growing rapidly, and I'm very impressed with that, it actually pales in comparison to the market cap. So I guess some of the things that you want to look at, a friend of the show, Claude Walker, who I know you know, Claude always asks this question on the analyst calls, and I love it that he does it because it makes my job easier. He asks, have you lost a tender that you've gone for this year? So just have you lost, you know, your ability to win a new customer? And every year the answer is no. And I think when you have a piece of medical software, they've got the Mayo Clinic, which is obviously probably the number one hospital system in the US. That's a really good coattail to ride on. But I think when you don't lose, and there are so many competitors like Fujifilm and many others out there in the market, it's a sign that your product is better when you haven't lost one. He said sometimes they might not win if it's not really a fair tender, but they've never lost a competitive tender and they charge more. So signs of a good moat, you know, your ability to retain customers and your ability to charge them more. Pro Medicus does that. I personally wouldn't buy shares today. I saw an analyst note come out that valued Pro Medicus at, I think it was $56 per share. My last valuation was in the 20s. So I don't know how there's such a disparity between what they're thinking and what I'm thinking, but I'm more willing to trust my numbers. The company, you know, is over $60 per share at the moment. It's just a stretch valuation, mate. I don't know, have much more to say. But if you're watching the company, just look at the deals that it's getting. Make sure it's renewing all those contracts. There was one deal in California, which is taking longer to renew, but that's for reasons outside of, I guess, the product. Analysts tend to get their knickers tied in a knot when they look at the receivables position, but that's often just a function of the business scaling with its exam revenue. So yeah, ultimately, at 72 times forward revenues, it's just not cheap. If CSL's expensive, this is expensive. This is expensive amongst CSLs. So that's pretty much my rant on Pro Medicus. I still own stock. I sold a bit. I got a spiffy pop yesterday when the value of my shares increased by the value of my investment when I first made the investment in a single day. I got a spiffy pop, so 100%. But I think Andrew Page is probably the number one on this. He got a 7x spiffy pop yesterday, meaning the value of his original investment went up 7 times yesterday. So you only get that through extremely long time horizons as an investor. I don't know if you've had one of them on Tesla yet, but yeah, I have a small slice and I'm happy to keep holding Pro Medicus. Still not my biggest position though. So yeah, that's Pro Medicus. Like it, love it, but wouldn't buy it right now.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add on Pro Medicus. I guess the only thing I'll add is one thing that's worthwhile thinking about for companies like this. So when you've got that kind of margin, right, the margin is really high. Mm. If you can have an EBITDA margin north of 40%, and you have recurring revenue. And I was just looking at the list of names, right? You've got Mayo Clinic, you know, you said best in the US, I'd say one of the best in the world. Mm. If you have a critical illness that nobody else can actually treat, you probably want to go to Mayo Clinic if you can afford it. UCLA Health, those names that they've got, those are top tier names. Like they have some of the best people there. So winning like halo clients is really a big deal. The way that I think about this and approach this is maybe 70 times, you know, here's the counter question, maybe 70 times is actually maybe not that expensive forward. If this was growing at say 50% or 100%, right? If this revenue was growing at 100%, then what is 70 times today is tomorrow in a year's time is 35 times. And then, you know, next year it's like 17 times, right? So it becomes cheap. My recollection with Pro Medicus has always been that it's not, does not grow at that fast pace. It's probably a 20-25% growth rate company at a CAGR basis, historically. So therefore, you have to think even more closely at the valuation because it's not growing at 100%. Then the only other question I would say is that, you know, one of the advantages of being in a niche area is that maybe the competition is not enough. And therefore, if you have made up a big name for yourself and your software is really good and your services are really good, then you win that. Mm. Probably, it's like a winners takes most, or maybe, a couple of people are going to own the marketplace. So the way I would think about this is, what's the TAM?
Mm.
Right. And then on these sort of things, you know, if you think of the TAM as say $X billion, and then you can get to 60% of that TAM. And there's no reason to believe that over a long period of time, that TAM could actually, deliver you consistent cash flows for decades, a couple of decades, maybe a decade and a half. Mm. That's a good framework to think about this. So that's for those people interested in thinking about, the expensive valuation. And I'm not saying it's cheap at all. 70 times for like 25% growth rate in my books is expensive. Like, in my filtering rate, I would filter that out. But I would caution by saying that maybe there is something here to think about, because those margins are really, really special, right? And then those names that you've got are really, really special. Those two things basically say something about the company, right? So that's just, just a random thought for something to think about.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So just as a really loose rule of thumb, Sam gets asked about this a lot, about the TAM. And when he came on the podcast a while ago, he mentioned a figure that might suggest the TAM is $1 billion, right? So
okay.
If you assume, say, $250 million of revenue by the end of the decade, say, 25% share, maybe it grows faster than that. I think the constant currency kind of masks the actual top line growth. So I think it's actually growing quite quickly. But I take your point. If you can find the company that grows at those rates, it heals a lot of the valuation wounds, so to speak. And so I'm still yet to update my valuation. It might be, $30. It might be a bit more. But one of the things, so a couple of the things to be mindful of is that they've talked about this move into lung and breast as potential areas of interest for their software and for their research hub that they've just started out of NYU, I believe, in New York. They're starting this kind of incubator. They've got one FDA approval across the line for an AI algorithm for breast density, which is really interesting. That's the space of Volpara, for those of you who follow that company quite well. So it's a really interesting way to expand the TAM. I think they have so many opportunities in front of them. One of the things that kind of irked me yesterday, mate, was on the call with Sam and ProMedicus. There are a lot of investment bankers, and there were a few questions brought up about M&A and that type of stuff. And I just hope that they don't go down that path too soon. I fully back ProMedicus's management, but you know as well as I do that when investment bankers kind of sink their teeth in, they have you on speed dial if you've got a bit of cash. So, and that can end in disaster a few years down the track. So, it's cashed up, could make some acquisitions, maybe expanding into other ologies, and also got the AI accelerator, which is kind of cool. So we should probably move on to the next company before we draw this out forever, which I love it, but our listeners are probably thinking, this is a long conversation. NetWealth, really interesting business. We've got a great lineup of companies here today. NetWealth, tell us about it. What does it do? What was the result all about? Go for it.
Yeah, so I'm going to just try to keep the next two shorter. So NetWealth is basically a wealth management business. Basically, it's independent advisors who manage money for others. They want a platform for managing those funds, and NetWealth is that modern platform that they would use. And it would basically cut it. It basically is it's like a toll booth, right? So it takes a small percentage of assets under management as fees. That's a very high level view of this company. So basically it's a software platform company, and it's been growing really, really, nicely. So I'll quickly share a slide like I do, because that makes it easier. Let's have a look at NetWealth presentation.
So while you're doing that, for those people that are listening, NetWealth competes against the likes of Hub24, which is another company that you might have seen on the ASX. Cool. Here we go. We've got NetWealth's Prezo.
All right. We've got NetWealth's Prezo. So the number of things, first thing I would look at here. So again, I had the pleasure of speaking with Hain Senior. Yeah. Or Heine Senior, as he liked to call it, his German name, and I probably butchered it again. wonderful, business person, entrepreneur, really brilliant outlook, which I really, I love that when I see that in a company's founder manager, really, really good. So really strong, income is total income is pretty high. EBITDA is pretty high. EBITDA margin, again, this is another one of those companies with really high
55% EBITDA margin.
Yeah, operating margin. This is really, really fantastic. This is a cash generating machine. It's a dividend generating machine as well. And look at this, the thing to look at here is look at the fund. Funds under advisement up, nearly 50%, funds under management up nearly 60%, right? I mean, look at the growth of clients, right? And this is really, really solid. And I think the way to think, I have to always start with this business, is just thinking of the landscape, right? So landscape is dominated by the folks like AMP, AMP, BT, Westpac, IUF Group, Macquarie. And and then there are the new age platform guys, NetWealth, Hub 24, Premium, right? And then they're taking share, right? So they're taking a lot of the inflows, right? So they're the thing to think about it is think about total market share. They're number six with a very tiny market share. If you look at the left hand side of the graph, right, but like 4%, 5%. But look at this graph where this you showed, they are number one when it comes to net inflows.
Yeah.
Right. So, this is a trend that's going in their favor. And that I think is really good. And then the market is huge. It's a humongous market in which they're playing. So and again, it's in software business. I really like it. I think, the valuation probably is also very reasonable. I think the shares were down on results. I'm not sure why. Maybe they didn't meet expectations. So again, they say,
it was margin compression. So just the competition and offering discounts.
Competition offering discounts. But I mean, here's the thing, right? I mean, margin, people are always worried about margin, but you can take a hit on margin if that means that you can get a larger piece of the pie, right? Because then they work out to be the same thing. You can have a smaller piece of the pie and have a higher margin, or you can take a larger piece of the pie and have a little bit less margin, right? So instead of making your margin as my opportunity, if you are the leader, you want to probably compete a bit on price as well. I think that's pretty smart. So again,
And once you capture the audience for these businesses, it's very sticky because it's not it's like very sticky. The advisor's going to uproot all of the client's money and run off to Hub if it was a hard integration or transition. So if you've got pricing power and you've got staying power,
exactly,
get them in the door.
So yeah, so I've always liked NetWealth. It doesn't have that kind of love. It doesn't have the ProMedicus kind of love, but it has a similar type of margin profile. It's in a big market. It's growing really quickly. Solid balance sheet and all those good things. So maybe it's one for the watch list for people to put on and just have a look and just have a dig through. And I'll just say Premium, for example, was beaten down for a long, long time until it wasn't.
Yeah.
Right. Again, sometimes you just have to be a little bit patient with some companies. So
yeah, I really like NetWealth. We've recommended it. I'm happy to buy shares today.
Great.
Yeah.
It that you've recommended it.
Yeah. We got one more company before we get into some stocks to watch. What is it, man? This is an interesting one.
This is Nearmap. This is another favorite. Used to be a favorite until it wasn't, right? I mean, the stock price at one point had run up. They had a $2+ or $3+ billion valuation at one point. I think it's half of that right now. So the company is called Nearmap. They basically take maps or what you would call is low-flying aircraft driven maps, which are useful for things like, so when I got solar put, for example, on my roof, the software that they used maps from Nearmap, right? Mm-hmm. And that's pretty standard actually across, it looks like the solar industry in Australia, parts of America and New Zealand and things like that. So they do mapping for various other reasons, whether it's for councils, whether it's for solar, it's for insurance reasons, for tracking reasons, asset management reasons, and things like that. So it's a very interesting business. Has for a long time, it was primarily a AU only business or ANZ only business and has expanded into US. And it's been a really dominant business here in Australia. There are a few others that do something similar, or at least one other that I know of that does something similar, but it's been dominant in Australia and they've been trying to recreate that success in the US. And that's really their story, right? US and they're in Canada as well now. So yeah, I think the issue with this one, the results, I think were looked, I would say look good, but I wouldn't say were great. I'll again share my screen if I can.
So is it annualized contract value up 18% year over year? What have we got here? Number of subscriptions, because they sell it on subscriptions, up 8% year over year. But I think you're about to talk about churn. Yes. Overheads down 15% or moving 15% against them. Sorry. So yes. This was an interesting point that you had about churn. We're trying to work it out before we came on air.
Yeah. So one of the things, Nick, so I like to look at this. So I'll give the company 100% marks here for being detailed in terms of what they release. So their analyst pack is actually very useful because they provide a lot of data points that you can actually put in a spreadsheet or look at it and read it and study it and things like that. And I think the thing that always confuses me is what they mean by retention. When they talk about retention, the definition basically says that they look at the retention of the annualized contract value. So what that means is you have a bunch of customers. Those customers have signed some deals with you. That translates into some amount of value for the year, right? And you want to see what percentage of that is retained. And I would guess that that includes upsell as well. So some customers might buy more from you. Some customers might leave, right? And you want to look at, you know, off the total that was in the beginning, how much do you have now, right? So, so ACV at the beginning minus churn plus upsell is how I would think of retention. But that kind of, I don't think that math worked out that way. So I'm not really sure what exactly is being reported here. We only spent a few minutes or 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes trying to figure this out. And retention rate is about 93% in FY21. And the second half was 93.1 again, which is pretty good. Then on the other hand, if you just look below that is this line on churn. This is actually an interesting one because it shows churn on a customer basis, right? And that's in the high 10%. If you think about,
So one in every 10 leaving a year based on subscriptions.
Yeah. So that's a pretty high, which basically, again, when we talked about Elmo last week, that's sort of, their issue as well, right? Higher churn. Xero has had the same issue. And this is basically pointing to a particular type of customer class. Small SMBs, and that makes sense, right? If you think of if solar companies are, solar installers are the ones using it, maybe some of them go bankrupt, some of them close their shop, maybe COVID is not good for them, example, right? As an example. Or maybe you have some government customer that decides that we needed to survey something for some project, now we no longer need to do that, and therefore we can discontinue the use. So that's something to keep in mind. The churn levels and the higher the churn, this is not enterprise grade software in that sense. And the recurringness is a bit of a question mark here. That's the thing I would think about. But again, the opportunity in the US should be 15, 20 times of the opportunity here in AU. So that's a big market, more competition, of course. And, there's a case to be made that what the ACV as reported at the end is around. So ACV is annual recurring revenue to some extent, is about 133, 134 million. This is what the market cap of this company is, probably a billion, I'm guessing, off the top of my head. Owen, can you help me out?
Yeah, I'll have a look.
I think it's around a billion. So a billion or maybe less?
One second. We are talking about 1.01 billion. So you were 0.01 billion off.
I am so good.
Take marks off you for that one, mate.
Yeah, I know, but I'm so good without even having. So, if you think on an ACV basis, it's about 7.5 times. So this is more expensive relative to Elmo, right? Elmo, we said it was somewhere around 4. This is 7.5. And so therefore, market is probably thinking it's growing. It has a bigger market opportunity relative to Elmo. But so something to think about is, what the right valuation for this company is, and the potential could grow the ACV at maybe 20% per year. Because if you look at this, they roughly grew that much, right? A little bit more than 20%, actually. 106 million last year to 134 million this year. So, and maybe this can continue for some time. So something to, again, I would put this company on, if you don't own it, put it on your watch list. You know, I'd think about the churn, but I'd also think about the multiples and sort of, you know, think about what it can do at steady state. I guess there's a bit of a cost component here to think about is you know, you need to fly those planes and make those maps. And So it's not pure software in that sense. So it's not, you know, again, something to think about. Those are my comments really about this one.
Yeah. So last year, 2020, went pretty severely backwards in terms of free cash flow, operating cash receipts, less all the stuff that goes into running the business. But then this year it broke even on a free cash flow basis. I was just doing the numbers as you're talking, $31 million of net operating cash flow. But then subtract $2.3 million of PP&E, $11.8 million for development costs and $20 million for capture costs. And you get to just below, so it's free cash flow negative, just. But if it can keep growing, particularly in the US, then that should hit an inflection point on cash flow and should kind of rally through that. There's another company on the ASX, which I know you alluded to earlier on, called Aerometrics, which is a much, much smaller company. From my research, Aerometrics is a company we've recommended and since gone backwards a bit, but it's much, much higher risk Aerometrics because it's not as mature as Nearmap. But from what I could tell, it seems to have better, clearer images and it doesn't have as wide a capture of Australia. It does have a better 3D offering. So interesting state of the market in terms of going to, like, a lot of the bigger use cases for infrastructure, for example, now are digital twins. And when you do a digital twin, so you have a map of the land, you want to be able to see it from multiple perspectives. And so 3D imagery is actually playing a bigger role in that. And so I think that's something to be mindful of too, is kind of like, where are the users going? And we know that Metromap by Aerometrics is actually growing quickly, whereas it seems to me that Nearmap is growing, but its churn's still pretty high. Not that it's terrible, but just something to be mindful of. Okay, mate. So we've chatted for forever. I love it, but let's get to some stock.
So we basically gave an extra stock tip.
We gave an extra one. We've given heaps today, but let's give ourselves, let's time ourselves, maybe a 60-second pitch, maybe 90 seconds for you, because yours might be new to people. But I'll go for my final one, which is Ava Risk Group, or Ava Global, however you want to define it, ASX, AVA. There's a ticker code. We were having a chat on Twitter before. It's just sold off one of its divisions, which was kind of like an armored guard type outsourcing services business. And now it's focusing on its future fiber technologies, FFT. I spoke to Rob, who was the CEO not too long ago, and didn't make the cut for our Rockets program, but because it was so lumpy and it was a bit kind of, the cohesion wasn't there across the divisions, but really interesting business. Basically, I'll give you the short version. It's got this new tech. It's called Aura IQ. And what it does is, it's fiber technology that runs around like the perimeter of a building or on a conveyor belt, and it can determine where on that conveyor belt one of the bearings might have broken based on vibrations or based on like security, if it's on a perimeter fence or something like that. It can even detect if people are walking on the surface of the ground, if it's buried below the ground, and it can be installed on existing fiber cable. So if you have broadband or something running around, it can actually be used for that as well, through that same network. So it's a really interesting business called Ava Risk, still really early stage. The pivot's kind of venture capital-like in that it hasn't really signed any major deals for ORIQ, although FFT is growing. It's going to have a bit of cash by the looks of it. Ava Risk Group, aka Ava Global, ASX, AVA. That's mine. What have you got for us?
Well, I've got a technology company called Upstart, listed in, I believe, in the NASDAQ. Code is UPST. And what they do is they basically work with banks. So they're basically a software company. They work with banks to help them decide whether or not a person should get a loan, right? And just to set the context, in the US, people use something called a FICO score, which is like a credit score, basically. Yep. And the FICO score is often, you know, the be all end all sort of thing. But then FICO score hides a lot of things, right? So you're not looking at, you know, so these guys are basically looking at a bunch of data points, your past history in terms of, you know, your education and things, your job. And they're using algorithms to basically decide whether or not you should be approved for a loan and at what rate, right? Mm-hmm. So there's two, you know, and then of course they have repayment data that flows through that that allows them to sort of fine tune these algorithms. The other really interesting thing about their process is 72% of the loans that they approve do not have any human intervention. This is all automated, right? And, you know, they expect that to move up a little bit more, creep up. But that, again, from a lending perspective is very interesting. So they're currently in what is called in the US known as a personal loan space, which is, it's basically, trying to consolidate, say, credit cards and other very high value, high interest loan items into a packaged loan at a lower interest rate and allow people to sort of get out of debt. That's a huge market. And they've just recently gotten into auto lending. Ross Cantor recently reported earnings. Have a look at the earnings. You know, the earnings grew. I think the earnings line grew by 1,000% or something like that, something ridiculous. This is a relatively small company from a US perspective. Tens of billion dollars of market capitalization.
$16.5 billion
in market capitalization, but growing at about 100% plus, profitable with pretty high margins, contribution margins in the high 40%, or maybe even actually more than that. I call it one of those businesses that can potentially be a very large fintech, but that's because of sort of their approach to, they're not anti-bank or fighting banks. They're working with banks to bring them, bring the 5,000-year-old industry into the modern age.
Mm.
That's the pitch.
Yeah, I like it. Upstart, UPST. I was just looking at Yahoo Finance. I very rarely go on Yahoo Finance. They present the most recent on the left column and the oldest on the right hand. So I'm reading back to front. My preference is reading left to right.
Yes.
So
and always, I have seen that in a few other places and it really throws you off. Like you said, but that doesn't sound, that doesn't, oh,
going because backwards.
You're going backwards, you know, and then in some of them at least have a column that you, or a tab that you can hit called reverse. Reverse order it.
Oh, right.
it can be really frustrating. So the PE for this company might be like 200 or something. But again, if you think of the growth rates, if you look forward, it probably is not that high. So anyways.
Okay, great. Upstart. Run for. So we've covered the jobless rate, Chinese tech, being in lockdown, how much fun that is, Redbubble, CSL, ProMedicus, NetWealth, Nearmap. We had mentioned Aerometrics in there and Hub. Talked about Ava Risk Group or Ava Global and Upstart UPST. Man, that's a lot to cover in one day, but thank you as always. That was heaps of fun.
And we did talk about Apple.
The
elephant, the problem really is that, you seem to be just as much of an Apple fan as I am. So we don't have a debate anymore. We just agree.
All right. I'll bring some counterpoints when they don't... So there's some rumors about the products. Maybe we can wait till they actually launch the products, but maybe we can bring the pros and cons when they bring out the new
I love line. The Apple Watch and I love my AirPods Max.
Someone at work did actually say that you've got, and for those, I apologize for those of you that are just listening on the podcast, but you've got the new Apple headphones as well. Has that transcended your listening experience?
Well, what can I say? So the new spatial audio thing is marvelous. And, it really, really changes how you perceive sound. And if you watch content on spatial audio, it is something. So I actually quite love it. But there's, they've remastered some old stuff into spatial audio, which is really, really cool. And then a lot of new stuff is coming in spatial audio. Spatial audio is really fun. And all of Apple's keynotes are on spatial audio. So you tilt your head and it seems like the sound is coming from in a slightly different direction. You get different, you hear slightly differently in each. It's just, it actually works with your AirPods as well. It doesn't have to be with AirPods Max.
Sold.
It's fantastic.
There goes one extra piece of inventory of Apple's books. Wonderful, mate. As always, thanks for, we've got one more thing. How can people find out about 7Investing?
Easy. Just go to 7investing.com.
That's it. Can't forget that. And they'll be able to get that free report, hopefully, in the next few days.
They'll get in. Oh, and how did they find Rask? You're not telling them that.
Oh, yeah. I almost forgot. rask.com.au. That's rask.com.au. You can find out more about our subscriptions and all that stuff there. And we'll be back next week. So jump on Twitter and say g'day and tell us what we got wrong and what we got right. So love to hear from you. Thanks, mate, as always, for joining me.
Thanks, Matt. Cheers.